previously on Something Who.
Welcome to the podcast where we take something old, a Doctor Who story from the original series, compare it with something new, one from the new series, and add something borrowed to make Something Who. Hello, I'm Richard, and we're back with Something Who podcast, where this time we're looking at two stories where technology turns up unexpectedly in a historical setting. We'll look at Fifth Doctor story, The King's Demons, from Season 20, and after that we'll examine 12th Doctor outing, The Girl Who Died, from Series 9. And with me to decide whether these stories are medieval magic or just a little bit tragic, I have with me the two regular co-hosts of Something Who, starting with our very own Sir Giles. So, hello, Giles.
Hello.
I hope you found plenty in these stories to satisfy your appetite for authentic science.
Oh, dear, dear. Yes, definitely.
Very good. And we also have our very own literary critic. So, hello, Paul. And I'm sure there's plenty of cod Shakespeare and gags for you to get your teeth into.
Oh, we can hope so. Yes, good evening, all.
So, The Girl Who Died, written by Jamie Matheson and Stephen Moffat, and directed by Ed Bazalgette. There's a name to conjure with from the media industry. Well, look, we're back to...
And sewage.
Situation normal.
sewage.
No. I haven't seen this since its original transmission, which apparently was the 17th of October 2015.
Me neither.
Yep, me likewise.
It was a frenetic start. I mean, I wrote down, there's battle fleets, Clara's upside down, she's being attacked by a parasite while suffocating, she's rescued, they talk about time travel and making waves, there's Vikings, the sonic sunglasses are broken, hooray! And that's only 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Cue titles.
I wonder why it starts like that, is my first question.
Because it slows down later on.
I had completely forgotten about that, I have to say.
Yeah.
I had completely forgotten the entire story when you first mentioned the title, but unlike that ghost hunting one the other week, it did come back to me as soon as I started. Yeah. I'd just forgotten this was ever a thing. Mm. Now, I'm going to have to ask you a question.
Go on then.
Shall I? Okay. Am I right in thinking that this pre-title sequence has nothing to do with the rest of the story?
Well, it doesn't feel like it does. I mean, the only way it has anything to do with the rest of the story is they get captured by Vikings at the end of it.
Yeah, because...
But aside from that...
I mean...
Go on.
The first thing I thought with the episode proper, this the first scene, they're taken back to the Viking camp, village. We meet everybody. The Doctor claims to be Odin, and then he's trumped when Odin appears in the sky, and I thought, well, that should be the pre-title sequence, and this should be where it ends, with that now traditional pre-titles cliffhanger, and then we get the titles, and then we come back. That would have been brilliant. Mm. Putting it there, it's a rather... I mean, it's a nice moment, but it's a rather anticlimactic, because we just carry on. So somebody shoved in a different pre-titles bit, possibly because it was more exciting, which had nothing to do with anything. It wasted 2 or 3 minutes, which we could have used in this story to flesh something out. So I was very mildly miffed about that.
Mm. It's odd because it doesn't feel like... I was watching it and I'm, maybe I'm missing something, but if I am, I suspect you two are as well, because neither of you's mentioned it yet. But I kind of watched it expecting it to be thematically when it had a cold... open, like, and I thought this doesn't have any connection at all to what I vaguely remember the rest of the story being about. I was then expecting, I was thinking, oh, it's probably doing something clever and like it'll have the thematic. And as you said, Richard, there's a little bit of discussion of ripples in time and things, but it doesn't really feel like it justifies being there for anything from
thematic to it actually being the same aliens that turn up later, so the Doctor caused it, or being. In any way, I mean, any of the 100 ways that a timey-wimey Doctor Who writer could link it in, it was odd. And it added to the... And considering how this, story ends with various call forwards, it just added to the feeling I had, which wasn't really a story in itself, as fun as it is in parts. It feels mostly like a setup for something coming.
I mean, you wonder. I mean, it's always hard to tell with unless you actually know, but it sort of feels like there's a Jamie Matheson story with a bit tacked on the front and the end that might well have been written by Stephen Moffat. I don't know. Or maybe it's less obvious than that.
There were lots of, quite a few stories in this era that felt a bit like that. And it's always well, I mean, we can probably find out. Truth is probably out there. But
yes,
stories where I felt as though possibly somebody had written an interesting thing that a one-off story which inspired Moffat. You thought there was more we could do here. And then he wrote a sequel to it, or I got that impression in with that sort of strange run of four in the following series. Bill, that maybe that had organically grown. I mean, here, on the other hand, if it wasn't planned in advance, that this was, if he didn't come up with the idea for Ashilda or me as she becomes, and give that to Jamie Matheson and say, can you introduce her here? The alternative is that Jamie Matheson wrote a story which was structured to lead towards the Doctor saving one person, exactly like he did in the Fires of Pompeii. And that would be an odd, and then it ends, and that would be an odd thing for him to have done.
Unless he wrote a story in which Ashilda dies, and that's a thing in itself.
What I've read indicates
one of us has done some research, Richard. Odin for that, Giles.
Enlighten us.
What I've read indicates that it was Moffat had the basic idea of having an immortal character that went the long way round.
Okay.
And then basically they were then looking, so the idea was this story would introduce them, and they didn't settle on exactly who or what she was, you know, so much. You know, it was I think they knew it would be a woman, but that seems to have been fixed that it would be a female character. But they didn't have anything else much.
How unusual, a female character whose life story is told in little chunks spread across an impossibly long period of time. Who could we be in?
So, yeah.
I'm never going to adore this story, but I liked it a lot more this time than I remember being quite irritated by it at the time. I remember Mo boring a pub full of Big Finish staff about it, and a few days after its original transmission. I won't name drop because it's not something I'm proud of. Thinking back to my desperate attempts to explain why I found it so underwhelming to what I laughingly thought were my peers. But, I mean, it seemed like another breath of fresh air, you know, a hurricane of fresh air after King's Demons, because exciting things were happening, exciting, witty, colourful things were happening.
Yeah.
But as it goes on, I remembered bits and pieces of why I wasn't so sure the first time. The pacing is very odd. I mean, continuing from that first scene, which has nothing to do with it, and then we come in and we get the introduction, it's not really structured like any other story, is it? It's the middle bit, the story itself, is so short, it's squeezed at both ends. That there's really no filler, but also no subplots, no nothing. It just happens. The ends come, they win a victory. The Doctor thinks there's nothing he can do. They're buggered, and then he thinks of an idea, and they win. I mean, it's talk of a short story idea. Most short stories worth a sort have more twists than that.
Well, I suppose, I mean, he doesn't have a plan. He doesn't have a plan. He still doesn't have a plan. And then suddenly he has a plan at the last minute.
Yes, indeed.
Because it's the first 10 minutes just move at this very fast pace. Get Clara and Ashilda onto the spaceship, and you know, so you've got all of the cold open stuff, the Odin impersonation, Odin in the sky, the raid, and putting them onto the spaceship, and then when they get down from the spaceship, it just grinds to a halt.
In a way that's unusual, but which I don't find justified.
No, that's the thing. I don't feel it's quite... It feels like it wants to be, let's do something weighty here.
Yeah,
it doesn't quite feel like the writing justifies what's there.
What they essentially present us with is a situation where, for the first time, the Doctor, who's never backed into a corner, who's always has a plan, the first time he's stumped, he's foxed, there's nothing he can do. And it just doesn't earn that, does it? It's not just me, is it? It feels... There's nothing particularly unusual about this situation. And they try to sell it. But it's a bit half-hearted. The only way they sell this, we're doomed, there's nothing we can do, they're going to come back and kill us all. The only way they try and sell it is by the Doctor saying these are the most fearsome warriors in the universe. Well, he says that. It's one line. They don't bloody look it. They look very generic, and their leader is not a very good actor.
No.
Who is it? He ruins it.
Yeah, he doesn't look at all impressive. It's quite similar to the Western one, isn't it? In the sense that there's going to be high noon at some point, and everyone's kind of, you know, waiting for that moment.
Yeah, now that was one where when I watched it the second time with you lot, it turned out to have more going for it than I'd remembered. But here, I mean, I don't know if it's fallen between two stools with the two writers without knowing who wrote what, but part of the problem is the supporting characters are so thin. It's very difficult to care about this situation. We're just told we should care because they're nice people. But apart from Ashildir, none of them get any... They're just comic relief, really, aren't they?
Yeah.
Very well,
you don't even get the comic relief in a way, because it's like Viking Academy, but you don't get to see them. You just get to see the aftermath of when it's all gone wrong. I mean, which is fine. I mean, it's a clever way of I suppose avoiding having to film a whole lot of complicated stuff. But yeah,
I mean, it's all right. None of it was bad. There's nothing embarrassingly bad, and some of it was wry. But fundamentally, it feels like there should be something a lot weightier in there. We should really care about these people, and the situation should be much more serious than it is. But if that was ever written, somebody else came along, took it out, and gagged it up, made it lighter, but not in a way that was funny enough to justify it. It just falls between the two stools. It's not either as weighty or as funny as it needs to be.
It's partly the baby, isn't it? So the baby is the character that seems to get the Doctor.
Yeah.
And then there's also a Shielder who has a few lines about how she's always realised that she's different, but this is where she's loved. So those two characters, I suppose, are the only ones that make you think, okay, well, we probably want to do something about it. As you say, the other ones are purely comic relief.
Yes, quite. Ashildir, that's a bit show-don't-tell as well, isn't it? She tells us how weird she is and how she's always been odd, and she tells stories, but we don't see any of that, do we? Unless I missed it. There needs to be a lot more set up. I mean, we just see little hints of her being slightly unusual at the beginning. But to set up that ending, which is quite a good, nice ending, using a vivid mind to implant a, what they ostentatiously call a story.
Why didn't we have a scene of her doing the whole giving it the Beowulf thing at the start? She should have been the village.
Absolutely, the village storyteller.
Yeah.
We get told she's. Well, what are they? That she's a bit of a
freak,
but also she's loved. So, which is it? Does everyone think she's weird, or do they all think she's lovable?
I mean, we see her being feisty with the kind of pathetic alien. So there's that. But yes, I agree. There's not a scene where people say, "Oh, Ashildir, you're a bit weird."
And that's such an obvious way, an easy way to set that up, that it does feel like it might have been cut somewhere. Out of been in an earlier draft and been lost. And that's a shame. I mean, yes, like I say, it all seems designed to forward character arcs, and the story, what little there is of it, is just there to set up Ashildir to forward the plot arc about Clara becoming more doctorish and more proactive and just jumping in and getting them in. Well, no, she doesn't get them in trouble, does she? Well, she sort of does the... She accidentally gets them transported up to the alien spaceship, doesn't she? And then she very cleverly tries to talk her way out of it and nearly gets away with it. But anyway, there's lots of stuff about her character. And then, of course, it ends with the long-delayed justification for why Capaldi looks the way he does, his face.
Yes, yeah. Not something that I'd ever been that bothered about, but...
Again, is that part of the shopping list? Was this another shopping list story? Did he give that to Jamie Matheson, or did he get sent, given the first draft and think, oh, I know, this reminds me of... No, he must have known. He must have at some point thought, if he hadn't known when he wrote Deep Breath, he must have since thought, I know, it'll be a reference to what was specific and unique about the fires of Pompeii. And we'll come back to that. We'll put the Doctor in a similar situation.
Yeah.
And this time, it won't work. This time it'll have... Because it's very heavily foreshadowed that the Doctor realises almost immediately he may have made a mistake this time. Doesn't he? Again, leading to the thought that... The feeling that this is not a complete story in itself. But, I mean, like I say... It all felt so superficial that the only time I felt anything... in this, and I'm not a monster. I don't have a heart of stone. I'm ready to tear up at a moment's notice. The only time I felt anything was when they had the call back to the fires of Pompeii. It took showing clips from a much, much better story to make me feel anything. I didn't really care about what happened to from Game of Thrones until I saw Donna begging the Doctor to just save one person. So that's not a good sign, is it?
Well, I mean, the other problem, I suppose, in this Moffat era is you're almost waiting for the dead to get resurrected, aren't you? it doesn't often feel as permanent as it should do.
It's not. I was going to say it's not only him, and then I realised that the example I was going to give of it happening in a different era was him. It's a minor problem I have with science fiction: the way some weeks death is permanent, and irreversible, and when it needs to be, and other weeks it's something you can fix with any random bit of alien technology. I mean, from his very first story, which we all loved, didn't we, the Antichild, the Doctor dances, they've essentially cheated death with the use of nanobots, right? Not even a particularly advanced technology, but which you'd think that would come in handy, but I don't remember anyone ever doing it again. Here we have yet another way of cheating it, which I suppose we're supposed to believe that he doesn't do it very often because he's aware that it could...
If only he'd held on to that bit of whatever it was rather than giving her two, he could have given that to Clara when the raven struck, right?
I was going to say it's a bit of a monkey's paw. Is that the analogy I'm looking for? Yes, he could.
Monkey's paw does. And for one thing, I'll say I quite like the individual bits. I found quite a bit of the training up the Vikings stuff in the middle of it quite fun. Is it one of these things where it's the classic thing of, okay, how come you can't change history, not one line, except when it's future history? It seems it feels like, because there's a discussion they have in the village before the somewhat tedious bit of the Doctor listening to the baby crying, which I felt stretched on far too long. But there's a discussion with Clara where he talks about the ripple effects and so on, and
yeah,
and it appears to be, you know, when he talks about, oh, well, that will draw more people in if I help them defeat. If they defeat them, then that will draw more people in and, more invasions and so on. And I'm thinking, hang on, so is this a problem just because this is in the past of, this happens to be in our specific past and we're threatening to send things off down a different timeline?
I didn't get that feeling, but I see what you mean.
I don't know. Not explicitly stated. I'm just thinking, is it the classic problem? They're just desperately trying to justify why this is something he doesn't want to. Why he doesn't want to interfere in this?
Yeah, from my point of view, in that part of the story, it was similar to the whole issue of sometimes dead is dead and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes this week, and they're trying to have their cake and eat it, aren't they? One minute he's saying there's nothing they can do, they can't fight, and then it's, well, we could fight, but if we do and we win, they'll come back and everyone will come for us. And I was thinking, would they? It sounds thin to me. It sounds implausible. It doesn't sound like you know, you don't say that any other week. And I thought, well, it's just specifically, a similar situation to things like the Pandorica, where Matt Smith stands and makes a speech saying this planet's defended and everyone is so terrified of him. Which, I mean, in most other Moffat stories, it's the absolute opposite. The Doctor can stand up and make a speech and the aliens run. So what's special about this week? It really goes contrary to them. the whole tone and message of most of the 11th and 12th Doctor's eras. And again, it all hinges on that one line about, oh no, these are the most fearsome. But we've already seen Daleks and Cybermen and all these other gits turn away from one of the Doctor's interminable monologues. But somehow these idiots, these stomping idiots, are supposed to be more feared than them. No, it's I don't buy it, mate. I don't buy
it. Yeah, the Planet Christmas, I suppose, as well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
If you look at it out of that surrounding context, then it's quite a neat gimmick, the idea that you set up this dilemma of, well, hang on, if we fight them off, that's just going to bring people back in greater numbers. And the solution being to embarrass them into retreating.
Yes. Yeah.
It doesn't actually labour that point, but the, the payoff
The payoff is nice, but the payoff is quite low key. The fact that it's quite comical that we embarrass them means that we didn't need all this faux gravitas to get there. There should have been another way.
And I do wonder whether part of the problem, and I think it was something we knew about in advance because Maisie Williams's casting was made suddenly off, and we knew she was in at least two. She was in at least this two-parter because they had matching titles. I'm not sure whether we knew she'd be back at the end of the series, but definitely I do wonder whether the matching titles and the fact that this makes the entire thing, okay, so we're waiting for this girl to die, and okay, right, so it's only going to happen at the last two minutes. It makes the whole thing all about her.
Yeah.
And then the thing that is apparently going to, that matters about her enough to put into the title doesn't happen until the last 5 minutes.
I see what you mean. It's like calling the King's Demons the Android.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
I went to see a play the other night.
Right.
All my Facebook followers have seen one of my very rare theatre reviews. I was so baffled by An Enemy of the People, starring Matt Smith.
Oh, right. Okay.
I needed to exercise my thoughts on why it didn't work for me. And not having seen, it's a modern adaptation of an Ibsen story set in a small town in Norway in 1882, and it didn't really, for my money, survive the translation to a modern milieu. And I was trying to think, is it just the adaptation I don't like, or would the original story have worked? Would it have seemed fresh and surprising 140 years ago, or was Ibsen an idiot as well? Was this never any good? Because I've never seen a play which was so unsurprising. Nothing happened that wasn't painfully obvious from the first scene. But that was partly because it was called An Enemy of the People.
Right.
And you assumed that that related to the main character. And you thought, I see where this is going. A nice man with lots of people around him all like him. But then he gets put in a difficult situation and you just know that we're going to spend 2 hours watching him gradually becoming an enemy of the people, and lo and behold, he did. Even the greats have fallen foul of giving away too much in their titles.
So if they called it A Terrific Chap, it would have been entirely different.
A Terrific Chap subtitle, you'll never guess what happens to it.
I quite like...
Terry Nation could have learned a few things.
Yes.
For that lesson, really, couldn't
they? Waking
I quite like the fact that in here, the Vikings aren't actually Vikings. They're just farmers. Because I guess Viking is a verb, really, rather than a noun. And these ones aren't Viking.
By Doctor Who historical standards, that's quite subtle, because we're always seeing the Saxons as the farming folk and all the Vikings.
Yeah.
Are warriors. What, and as if, what happened to the rest of them? Did they just... Of course, once they'd done their Vikinging, settle somewhere, then there'd be farmers as well. I mean, just like Anglo-Normans aren't French.
Yeah.
There are more nuances to real history.
Yeah. I couldn't quite work out, are they supposed to be in Denmark or Norway or somewhere like that? I mean, they said they were 2 days boating away. I mean, but then we don't really know where they were picked up from in the first place. They could have been picked up in Norway or Denmark or somewhere. And equally, they could have been in the north of England because, there were Vikings there. So who knows?
Well, apparently the first draft of this, which was called Valkyrie, wasn't called The Girl Who Died, involved Valkyries on flying horses
Right.
doing the kidnappings on Lindisfarne.
Okay.
Valkyries and Flying Horses. It could have had it before Marvel.
Could have had it before Thor, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I think I'm going to say before the title sequence.
That too.
Mm. I mean, did you buy for a second that the Doctor gave up and thought there's nothing they could do? He always has a plan. He always does his Scooby-Doo or his 18-bit where they get locked in a barn and have to come up with some Deus Ex Machina out of a box of scraps, like Iron Man in his cave, or Scooby-Doo. Seconds of Scooby-Doo, at the end of Act 2 of every episode, they make up this trap to catch the masked villain. And that's what Doctor Who is. He is that man. I didn't buy that he was defeated by this.
Yeah.
When did Doctor Who become all about the Doctor? Watching these out of order sometimes obfuscates trends and sometimes makes me spot them, because I feel like he didn't shut up in this episode. It was mostly him and Clara, and the supporting characters suffered. They didn't get enough screen time, even though they were thinly written, they just didn't get enough screen time. And I feel like that happens a lot in this era. You got very verbose doctors and very verbose companions. They just dominate. They suck all the air out of every scene they're in. But here it's him more than. Does it happen progressively? Every doctor of the new series era is slightly more verbose than the last one. Is Capaldi the worst? He just doesn't shut up. I get fed up with him, with his monologues. Yes, you get a great actor, you want to give him speeches, but maybe they're more effective if they're used sparingly. It's just. It's the combination of the dominating personality when they do that Tom Baker thing of commanding the scene. But Tom Baker did that, not him personally, the Fourth Doctor did that without talking 19 to the dozen.
Well, the first few over series everyone. Anyway.
He would choose his moments. But now these modern Doctors, and I think it might peak here.
Yeah, well, Whittaker is less to the fore, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, it's of course that didn't continue the same trend. Although I was partly thinking it's similar. It's like it takes a slight deep left turn into something similar but different, in that she does do a lot of speechifying, but it's different. Her Doctor doesn't dominate in that tall, in a very literal way that the 12th Doctor does, looking down on everybody.
More of a flat team structure.
And hectoring them with sarcasm or whatever. You know, he's got it all going for him. The height, the sarcastic personality, the tendency to speechify. Whereas she somehow managed, because of the inept writing of the 13th Doctor's era, to dominate in a not particularly dominating way. But that's I'm getting slightly off the point. I found him mildly annoying because there was too much of him. You know, too much of a good thing.
So how electric is an electric eel?
Not. I think the main problem is there shouldn't be electric eels in anywhere the Vikings are.
Right.
Oh.
I think, aren't they just South American?
God. But how many would you need? 1,000? 1,000,000? A billion?
Oh, God knows. I know. One hears stories about horses. I should have done my research, shouldn't I?
I mean, this should have been the most ingenious thing the Doctor's ever done, because they make a big point about her as no TARDIS, no sonic glasses, and no whatever else, as if that's incredibly unusual. But of course, that's mostly the situation he was in through most of Doctor Who. In proper Doctor Who, he never went back to the TARDIS. The TARDIS was never used as a plot point, was it? Until the 80s.
This is strangely specific. It says they deliver shocks at up to 860 volts.
860, eh?
Not 870.
Yeah.
It is very specific. They are indeed South American, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, the Vikings got about.
Yeah, well, yes.
Yeah.
You could justify a quick trip all the way down the eastern seaboard. near Ferrixon, or wherever it was.
Oh, yeah, they're in... They're sort of bordering the Caribbean, the top end of South America. So, yeah, it's almost plausible, but not really.
So Doctor Who's magic Medi-Patch thing, where does he get it from? From one of the soldiers? From the Hetzer?
Yes, yeah.
Right. Okay. It also has it savours of something that happens occasionally in New Who, where it's quite a nice idea that you think they could have done more with, and then they sort of throw it away at the beginning. When Odin appears in the sky, and it's played as a gag, but
yeah,
I like the idea of these gits that go around the universe pretending to be local gods.
Mm.
It's
It's a shame it's not big. Well,
the Marvel view of gods, like the underexplored Gore the God Butcher in the most recent Thor film. Mm. Where you see all the gods from different traditions lined up together and they all actually are extant. It's like that, but the complete opposite.
Mm.
But maybe the whole thing should have been...
It's a shame it's not Bran Blessed, of course.
Odin's alive!
Odin, yeah. Well, it was written for him. And with
right.
Danny, and had his collapse on stage and had to drop out.
Oh, dear.
When he was playing King Lear at the time, unfortunately. Mm. Fortunately, he seems to have made a fairly decent recovery of it, but I do think it would have added a certain something.
Yeah.
But I'm blessed, basically.
I mean, a man who actually was quite a good actor and then became a caricature, but if there's ever a part that requires a caricature, this was probably it.
Mm, yes, yeah. Because this is, it's not quite played. Yeah, it's not really played large enough, really, is it? I don't think.
No.
So the entire justification is they just go around picking fights and Odin wants his monkey glands, basically.
Yeah.
Juice, mate, warrior juice.
They're far too specific when he says that it's adrenaline and testosterone, because that's, I think they should have left that a bit more vague.
But they
said that they could give Clara a gag about there being too much testosterone in the universe.
Mm. Yeah.
Ha, 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 but it's not as simple as... I don't think, biologically speaking, it's quite as simple as that, as we all have it.
Hmm.
But,
Are we going into all on this?
Is it a particularly short episode? It felt short. Maybe it's because it was split into so many.
Not particularly. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of bits thrown in here. There's a reverse of polarity of the neutron flow here. And there's live forever barring accidents there. Yeah. And... there's a technology indistinguishable from magic over in another place. There's lots of stuff that seems to be a reference to something someone said elsewhere.
Hmm.
The episode received very positive reviews from critics.
Hmm.
Yes, apparently it went down an absolute storm. I don't remember being blown away by it at the time, so I don't think it's...
I'm not as annoyed by it as I was at the time, but I think I was annoyed because it was such a waste, because... It could have been so much better if they just picked a direction to go in.
Hmm.
And I wouldn't even say they're hedging their bets. It just seemed confused.
I think it's really hard to pin down, because I think the basic plot is pretty watertight. It's quite, as much as a Doctor Who plot ever gets. I think it's quite natty little ideas, but it needs some more characterization. Maybe a bit, I don't know, the pacing feels off. But I mean, the whole idea of hijacking the fact they all see through these visors and so you hijack the system and all of that is quite a nice idea. And
I think all the ideas are very good.
They should have amped up the idea that Ashildur was a storyteller and, as you say, show don't tell.
She could have been a really memorable character. She's by far the best character in it, as it is. And I seem to remember she doesn't... This is the high point, isn't it? I mean, I remember not really believing her story as she went on through the rest.
I carried on. I let it spin on to the next episode because I was trying to remember what's...
Okay.
I don't think... I remember thinking at the time with this, is this who everyone's... been on about, because having not seen Game of Thrones, it's just like, oh really? But I find her quite good at, but then the thing is this story doesn't have anything that, it doesn't require her to play anything other than anything outside of her normality, as it were, because I think she was 17 or so when they recorded this, and I think so it's she's playing a 17-year-old girl, and I think she does it fairly well. She probably is the best thing in it. I think she was pretty good in as much of The Woman Who Lived as I got through, because that gets into a lot more of the nitty-gritty of what the Doctor has done to her and what the implications of living for whatever she's been around for 800 years or so by that point, just living a day at a time but without aging. And it is, yeah, I think it's pretty good, the performance there. I think more of it now again than I did at the time, but I can't remember quite where. Yeah, when we get to that end two-parter of the season, can't quite remember. I seem to remember that going off the boil.
Yeah, I mean, I quite enjoyed watching it this time. I mean, I didn't think it was outstanding, but I thought it was, it was a fun way of spending the time that we were watching it. I would think I'd agree with you, Giles, that I found the pacing a bit odd, that there was, there was quite a lot of stuff happening very quickly at times, and then quite nothing very much happening for quite long periods as well. And, I'm sure it was done on purpose, but it just felt like maybe it could have been evened out slightly.
Well, there we go. But sometimes these pairings can lift or lower a story, and I feel a lot more warm to it having just watched The King's Demons immediately before, which didn't even manage to fill 50 minutes.
Can anyone remember reading the novelization of The King's Demons?
Yeah, I thought it was. Well, I was about to say it was really good. I remember it being a good one, but then I think I always liked it when they expanded a two-parter into a full-length
Because that's the thing, I
novelization.
remember it being quite a chunky,
But how the hell?
very chunky book. So,
Yeah, I only remember my own, which was quite a short book.
Did you finish it? Cause
Oh, I did. Yeah, I did finish it,
bloody hell, I didn't get.
But I don't think that I did
Did
very
you fix?
much.
Did you fix? Did you fix the ending?
No, I don't think that I did very much more than just transcribe the dialogue with a few the doctor said, and it was a large room with three people and a table or
Yeah,
something.
and a
I don't think I
pleasant
did anything
open
very
face.
exciting. Yeah.
I think it was trying that at that young age that put me off the idea of writing books. I didn't try again for 40 years, so that was a bit of a waste of time.
We've got technology unexpectedly, well, in both of them, I suppose, except that perhaps it isn't. Yeah, I suppose when Odin appears in the sky, that's a big surprise, and I suppose the first time you see Chameleon, it's a bit of a surprise. Although the fact the master's there by then maybe takes away slightly from that. In both of them, you've got the fact that the Doctor turns the tables by using the technology against the aggressor. So, I mean, basically, in both times, it's also the way out. I mean, yes, the electric eels come into it in The Girl Who Died, but he wouldn't be able to defeat them if he wasn't nicking their guns and, taking the stuff out of the helmet and so on. And equally, well, it's sort of a bit of a close run thing between Teagle and the TARDIS and the battle of wits with Chameleon as to what wins the day there.
Impersonation, I guess, of
Yeah.
little bit of a theme with King John and Odin. Villains impersonating, authority figures.
Yeah. And I mean it. I think in both cases, there's a slight sense of disappointment. I mean, you mentioned it in the Girl Who Lived, Paul, that the Doctor seems to be in a position where he's going to have to use his wits, and then he doesn't so much. It sort of it feels like Davison is sort of up against it. He's got, he has to battle his way out of a situation with a sword and so on, and then all he has to do is sort of screw his face up and concentrate hard and then sort of wins the day that way. And, electric eels. And then I mean there's definitely a theme about technology and magic being quite close if you don't understand the technology.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they both. What do the Vikings think the Doctor and Clara are at the beginning, or do we not? Do they not say? Do we not care? Does the Doctor? Do they just think they're a couple of non-Vikings, and that's why they don't like them. Because I'm just thinking, you know, we, in a sense, both stories toy with the idea of them being jumped upon by suspicious...
Actually, that is a bit weird.
Pre-modern people.
Because why would the why would the Vikings waste time on a couple of captives unless they were going to make them into slaves?
Well, they take them a long way, don't they? Purely for the plot point of being separated from the TARDIS. Yes.
It feels like they would have been sold into slavery if that's what they were going to do.
It's not clear if they've asked many questions on the way there, because the Doctor only pulls his Odin gambit.
Hmm.
They're not being imminently threatened with death at that point, are they? When he pulls his Odin gambit? I can't remember. Anyway, at least they get accepted fairly quickly because something worse comes along rather than the whole story being about nobody believing him, which is my least favourite type of Doctor Who, as I mention every time it happens.
Happened a lot in the Davison era, didn't it? It was basically the standard plot. In fact, it happens twice in Earthshock.
I don't know if anyone's ever asked Eric Saywood if that was down to him, but if I feel like he would say, well, yes, it was. That was my idea, because I thought to myself, I thought it through very logically. What would happen if these advanced beings arrive in these situations and people wouldn't trust them? I wouldn't trust them, would you? People, they would get arrested and held at gunpoint and tortured and accused of being spies. It's very realistic. That's what would happen. And you'd think, well, you're making a drama, not a documentary.
Yeah, I'm liking Earthshock less now you've mentioned it, actually, the fact that it happens twice. basically the same plot in both halves. Anyway, there we go.
Mm.
He didn't say that, I just put words in his mouth.
No, but you sounded very much like him, I felt.
I tried. I saw him at the weekend. I was at a mini, one of his little conventions at Riverside. Mm. He was there, Davo was there, Adric crowbarred his way in.
Mm.
I
thought that looked quite interesting, but it's just as well I didn't get buy a ticket for it because I was unwell over the weekend. But yeah, no, it was a nice bunch of guests. That
what was that, the Androzani screening? Oh, you made it. Okay, sold out by the time I found out about it.
Mm.
Yes, I was press ganged by somebody else. Obviously, I didn't have the initiative to get involved in my own bat. Somebody else said, do you want to go to that? I sat on it for a few hours thinking, oh, well, I've got plenty of time to make a decision. And by the time I went and checked, there were two seats left, so I bought
them.
Yeah. Still a lot of fans left around.
Mm.
Well, enough to fill a small lecture theatre.
Yeah.
Mm.
But, I mean, the other ones of that type took quite a long time to sell out, but obviously it must have fallen into a sweet spot. That maybe Androzani people think would be more fun to watch than three very grainy black and white stories, and maybe the guests as well.
There's a very, very starry guest list.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
And a lot of people there for autographs and photographs,
mm.
including, as it turned out, surprise, to my own surprise, me.
Mm.
Okay.
Perhaps.
They'd almost finished the photographs when I suddenly got overcome by an urge to have one. So I said, is there still. Have you done the Davison Bryant's Waterhouse combination? They said, yes, about half an hour ago. They all sat down over there now and joined themselves. And I said, I don't suppose there's any chance. And the photographer dragged them back up.
Right.
Was very sarcastic about it. I mean, I probably deserved it, but I don't know. I mean, he was so sarcastic, I think. I don't know if anyone deserved quite the tongue lashing I got. But the actors bravely put smiles on.
For the duration
of the photograph.
Did they recognise you from the Big Finish buffet?
No.
Oh.
No. Nobody recognised me.
Mm. Oh, well. that's maybe a small blessing. Yeah. I mean, I wonder also if perhaps it's because the Five Doctors screening sold out so quickly at the BFI, and maybe some people who missed out on that one were kind of keen to see some of the same people in another.
I can recommend it. It's always worth seeing Davison, always good value.
Hmm.
I think he is extraordinarily good value, actually. Yeah, he's excellent.
Unlike the photograph that I forced them to take on me. Bloody hell.
Did they get the wrong side of you?
I should be eating like a church mouse for the rest of the month. No, it's a nice photograph, but the it was very expensive.
Oh, I see.
But, you know,
well, because there's so many of them, yeah.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah.
You don't get a discount.
Yeah. I'm always a bit of a what's the word? I feel like I'm subverting the system because I go along to things like that and I pay the entrance price and sort of watch the stuff and go to the panels and don't bother to buy the autographs or the photos. So I feel like probably that's the sort of guest they really don't want to come along. Not a guest, the sort of punter they don't want to come along because...
I don't know.
Because actually what it's all there for is the autographs and the photos.
Mm-hmm. The merch?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I think there's room for all... takes all types.
Mm.
Mm. Sorry to derail the conversation.
No, I think this is gold as usual. Yeah. So are we there with this second half?
Yeah, baby.
I think so. Can't think of any other particular links or anything.
Okay, in which case, thanks for listening to Something Who. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. And if you check out our feed, there's about 100 others that you could listen to while you're waiting for the next one to land, which, you know, probably is going to be in about a month's time. That's sort of where we're going with this. About once a month, but, you know, it is just a fun thing we do in our spare time. So be patient with us if it doesn't come out quite that often. It's all for free, but we do enjoy making them. So yeah, there'll be one sooner or later. If you like Something Who, please tell your friends, your family, your colleagues, your neighbours, and any suspicious shape-shifting characters you come across. But if you hate us, don't tell us all. Which just leaves me to say thank you, Paul and Giles. It's been nice to get the old team back together again for one more of these.
Yes, indeed. Enjoyed it.
Who knows who will be on the next one?
Right.
People are climbing over each other to get to you, aren't they?
I think that's probably overstating it. There are several people who are mildly interested in, you know, coming along if they're not doing anything else that evening. I think we could safely say that.
Well, bye for now, all.
Indeed, tatty bye.
Bye. Number one in Singapore, baby.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, on the strength of that, three downloads, I think. But yeah,
is this episode 93? Good lord!
Why did you say there are about 100 episodes available?
Because not all of them have been numbered, and some of them have been numbered weirdly. So, there was
and 13 cast started up.
Yes, there was all those ones as well.
But I assume you're not going to do a rustle. We are going to celebrate number 100.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. If I go,
everyone on at the same time.
Oh God!
I'm just.
that's Moffat, isn't it? Everything, everywhere, all at once, review, or something. Yeah.
I'm just trying to think what could we review for that.
Yeah. It would have to be that episode, wouldn't it? You know, where is the Wedding River Song or something?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. That would be it. Yeah.
Everyone all together. Or it would be the Russell T. Davis thing, wouldn't it? The All People Together Against Davros and the Daleks.
Oh, yes. Did we talk about Celestial Toy Maker last time, Richard? The screening, the animation?
No.
Hmm.
The idea, I think, is that we're going to do Toymaker and The Giggle because Gavin Rymel's interested in doing that one. So we might.
You're not doing the you're not doing the Toymaker without me.
Fine. I think we're good on that. Yeah, I think there's space for everyone.
Paul was there. I saw him sneaking off the moment he saw me sitting down. Waking or sleeping, Paul, I am with you.
Sorry, just changed my mind about what drink I was going to have at the last second.